What happened this week? What does it all mean? Welcome to Friday and welcome to KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Happy to have my panel today. Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, Bill.
Welcome. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Hiya.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in. You too. But Knut Berger, cross-cut writer, columnist, The Moss Bag. Nice to see you too, Knut.
Nice to see you, Bill.
Thanks for crunching through the snow. We still have crunchy snow. I know that's not like it doesn't never snow here. I know some, but somehow the order of events with the big snowfall, at least where I am, and then the freezing, and then the lingering, and then and the cold. I grew up in suburban Omaha, and I've had a. It's an unconscious thing. It's a sense memory. I've walked outside more than once, and I am once again delivering the Omaha World Herald with three pairs of pants, you know, age 12 or whatever, crunching through the snow. So I don't know why I'm telling you that.
We're all digging.
I felt like
we're all digging just that you're telling us that. None of us are,
how are you doing?
Digging snow. We don't actually. It's not deep enough for
not
that.
Not that. It's not that deep. It's going to be cold. When's the Seahawks game?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
About 5 o'clock.
Starting to warm up eventually.
37 degrees and ice rain is the forecast for that.
Well, here's to a hopefully happy new year. And let's talk about some of the stories making news this week. We should not be able to use our phones in the car as much as we do, according to sponsors of a bill coming to the Washington legislature. Session begins on Monday. You're already not allowed to text. You're already not allowed to hold your phone to your ear. And the proposal is that you can't even hold your phone in front of you, as some of us do. You can't look at an email, look at Facebook, et cetera. Good idea?
Oh, I think it's a really good idea. I think we should change the name of this law to the Distracted Lawmakers Law, because they must be so distracted not to know that this is the next drunk driving crusade and that they need to get on it. I mean, you know, we've had a law that's pretty outdated and doesn't make any sense. It was written in 2008. It was updated ever so slightly in 2010. The gist of it is that you can't hold the phone next to your ear. Did you also know you can hold it out in front of your chin? That was one of the interpretations of it.
You currently can, right? You can hold it on speakerphone
in front of your chin. A state trooper explained this to me once. But if you hold
when
it,
you got pulled over for
called him on the phone. Don't try to go there, Eli.
I'm just trying to clarify the story.
It was on the phone. It was for I've spent a lot of time with the troopers.
With the state troopers?
And other capacities there. Mm-hmm. But the gist of this is that you actually can hold it out in front of your chin. I mean, you can order Tide on Amazon if you want to, but you can't hold it next to your ear. They need to update it.
I thought you said order tie at first, which is also very
not a bad idea. You could do that too. But
I've got this image now of Joni pulled over for speeding, ordering Thai food while she's waiting for the trooper to do his business.
Laundry detergent.
It's really hard to eat pho in the car.
It is. You know? Possibly you could put your phone in a cradle in your dashboard. That's under discussion right now, as long as you don't touch the phone while driving.
Well, I like the part in the story where they explain the slowness of lawmakers to act on this by pointing out that there's at least one lawmaker in Olympia who likes to stream Netflix movies, I think, while he's driving.
Watch TV episodes.
It is a long ride, right?
Well, it is a long ride. There's a lot of people you pass on the freeway swerving into their lanes potentially while watching your Netflix
movies. I was going to say, you can tell from other people driving that a lot of people are doing that. And you particularly notice it, and this is where it's really tempting to get your phone out and check your email, is when you're at a long stop sign.
Everyone's on the phone.
Yeah, and everybody thinks, oh, it's safe now because I'm stopped, but
it is safe, isn't it?
No, it isn't. No,
well,
it isn't.
How is it not safe to be stacked in a line at a red light and looking at your phone?
When you're looking at your phone and you are distracted, you are not able to sort of take in the whole intersection. You are not able to see
what
somebody.
Taking in do I have to do at a red light?
You have plenty of taking in to do when someone's walking across or they're darting out. Come on, you guys, you know that.
Well, there are plenty of distractions that occur. I mean, you know, the coffee holder. And, you know, whether the coffee is spilling, you see women putting makeup on in the car with the little mirror on the screen.
Before we wail on women, guys brushing their teeth, shaving, the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot.
I have shaved in the
lot
car.
Of
I've done that.
You've shaved in the car?
Absolutely.
The full lather and rinse and all of it?
It's Santa Claus.
The guy in the front seat with the strop.
Yes, I mean, right.
The razor.
No, they've actually come quite a way technologically in that department. You should look into it.
Warm towel?
Here's the thing. It's according to the Seattle Times article I read, it's not only dangerous, documented dangerous, to look away from the road, but that even hands-free listening makes people weave more, which is not my experience. Is that really your experience?
Well, I was wondering about that because so hands-free listening, how is that any different than me listening to a podcast while I'm on a long car ride? I'm just
I think you meant to say to KUOW, but I take your point.
To the KUOW
podcast. Yes.
Right. And so how, you know, if I'm listening to Bill talk to me, talk me through a long drive, how is that any different from a hands-free device?
Yeah, Joni.
Yeah, this is on me, right?
Yeah, you're the scold for this segment.
You're hanging with the state troopers, telling them to pull us over.
I think it's all the fumbling you know, trying to get different stations. When you're with Bill, you do not go to another station. Who would do that? Who would do that? So
that's
I would rather
fair. It's the thumbing around.
Yeah, it's all and believe me, when a little message pops up, you look at it, and when an email pops up, it looks so provocative. You're gonna do it. You're gonna go for it. I'd rather be in a driverless car. Than having people next to me on the road driving around, you know, holding their phones, because at least the driverless car is trying to get you there safely.
I agree with you, by the way, on all of this. I'm for driverless cars and I'm for ratcheting up the restrictions on using cell phones while driving as someone who bikes in traffic a lot.
There you go.
And doesn't have, a ton of steel protecting me. You see this all the time. You see drivers who are swerving, who make a turn without looking at who's in front of them.
But then make that illegal.
Make
the swerving?
The swerving.
That behavior
itself.
That
is already illegal.
Yeah.
It is already illegal, yeah.
Okay.
But I don't buy that argument, because we already make things illegal that increase your tendency to engage in dangerous behavior in a car. For example, drinking, right? That is illegal while driving because of the behavior that you would likely engage in while
drinking alcohol. Because you can eat fast food while you're driving, and you can drink soda while you're driving.
And you can shave.
Here's the thing. If the goal were to prevent all crashes, we would outlaw cars. That's not the goal. Our goal is to be safe until safety becomes too inconvenient. So the question is being in your car without the ability to use your phone unreasonably inconvenient? And then we can have a discussion about that. I can see that.
Well,
but let's not pretend that we're doing everything, you know.
We're not doing everything. We're doing sensible things to be safer.
Well, what's interesting is we've made cars themselves safer. Okay, so, you know, fewer people are killed in accidents because cars are better built, right? So one of the things we've done is we've turned cars into rumpus rooms, you know.
Right.
And also computer centers. I drive a car that actually has, you know, a touch screen on it. So the radio and the cell phone connection, navigation, everything is on a touch screen. Mm-hmm. I can get just as distracted trying to hit the right button on the touch screen when I'm driving through Seattle's potholes.
Yes.
As I would be with a cell phone.
Perfect scenario.
Now, the other thing is that gas stations used to sell paper maps, but now they assume everybody has smartphone, right? GPS or a smartphone. So when you go on like cross-country trips and need a map, good luck finding one. Good luck finding one that gives you any detail about the locality. You can buy these big road atlases. But
have we swerved into man yelling at cloud at this point?
No. What I'm saying
that
is
map
this
was really dangerous when you opened it all the way up, unfolded it while you were driving. You really couldn't see.
Yeah. No. My point is, though, that there's this kind of fun. It goes to your point, Bill, which is there's this kind of thing happening, which is people are doing more in the car because cars do more, whereas when cars were very simple and required, you know, physical strength to turn the wheel because you didn't have power steering, you kind of had to pay more attention.
Can I offer a fun fact here? Did you know that President Obama, in one of his 266 executive orders, banned federal employees for driving while on a cell phone? Thanks, Obama.
Just to give a sense of how
that'll get repealed and replaced.
Just to give a sense of how pervasive this problem is.
In about 2 weeks.
Joni, you're gonna like this. It supports all your arguments about how pervasive this problem is. I just got a text from a friend and a listener, loyal listener.
In the car.
Who says, I'm texting you at an intersection while listening to you on the radio talking about texting at an intersection.
See?
My work is done.
And I'm not saying that there should be no laws around this. I just somewhere in the argument, I'm pointing out that one more thing, which is that when you are in gridlock, one of the saving graces, whether you like it or not, whether it makes good for good policy or not, one of your saving graces is that you can get something done. You can swipe. You can look, and it's just not as horrible to be there.
Back in the men yelling at clouds department,
okay.
or people enough. Railing against the passage of time and quote unquote progress, there used to be a time when it wasn't so horrible to sit at an intersection and do nothing, not get work accomplished.
Well, there I agree with you.
Communicate with anyone.
Now you're in my world. I actually don't mind driving or being in traffic. I like the whole experience. But that's a self-help podcast that we'll be launching very, very soon. Listen, before we leave the legislature, which is this where this proposal is, the legislature convenes next week. We'll be talking about it when it happens. Can our listeners do anything to, I don't know, sway their lawmaker now, or is it all preordained? Is there anything we really ought to know right now about the legislature, or honestly, should we put it off?
You can text them. Or
you
call them.
Yes.
Maybe not while driving.
In traffic.
But also, you should clue into the many, many other, and I guess we'll be talking about them, important laws that are under consideration this session, including some bills that may finally give us adequate public education funding in this state.
I don't know. I think the legislature is currently being fined for distracted legislating.
That's what I said. Clearing. At the top, right at the top. Right. Distracted legislating.
Yep.
You'll see plenty of it.
Okay, we'll talk plenty of it in future days, if there are any future days, considering that North Korea has a nuclear missile aimed at us. That and more coming up on The Week in Review. It's KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Eli Sanders and Joni Balter and Knute Berger and the former head. By the way, we're live tweeting this show at KUOW. Our social media producer, Kara McDermott, did we get any more tweets while people were driving? Please let us know if I should yell at someone to put down the communication device. Okay, the former head of the CIA has given us yet another reason to worry.
The North Koreans will be able to reach Seattle with a nuclear weapon on board an indigenously produced intercontinental ballistic missile.
That was General Michael Hayden predicting that by the end of Trump's first 4 years in office, North Korea could reach Seattle with a nuclear weapon. This week, President-elect Trump tweeted, "That will never happen." But I interviewed the president of the National Bureau of Asian Research, Richard Ellings, who said Seattle is a juicy target.
Oh, my gosh. Except for Washington, D.C., the best target they could have. Not only are we the shining city on the hill with all these amazing companies, we have Boeing, one of the most critical defense contractors. We have JBLM, the Joint Base Lewis-McChord, whose main purpose down there, I-Corps, is to reinforce the peninsula, the Korean Peninsula, in the case of invasion. We are the ultimate strategic and symbolic target.
Happy New Year! Elling says he likes that Trump wants to expand America's nuclear weapons capability. Knute, nukes aimed at us, American buildup, Russia hacking our political parties. Is the Cold War back?
Yeah, it makes me feel strangely congruent, having been a Cold War child, a child of the Cold War.
You've returned.
And back in the 50s and 60s, of course, we used to have the drills about atomic bomb drills. Hiding under the desks and all that kind of thing. But what, you know, kids anyway used to take some pride. I remember discussion actually, pride of people saying, well, you know, Seattle is a number one target. People thought it was kind of cool. It was like something that put Seattle on the map. That's about to be wiped out. Yeah, moments of...
You're on the map, you're off the map.
It comes, it goes.
There's a lot of discussion. I mean, just about the North Korea thing. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, whether they have a missile capable of reaching the U.S. And it's clear they currently have missiles without nuclear warheads that can hit Alaska, which is the closest thing. So the closest, we're sort of the closest big city mainland target south of Anchorage. And San Francisco and Los Angeles are mentioned if they develop the kind of missile that can, successfully, an ICBM, you know, that can carry a nuclear weapon to Seattle, they'll probably also have the capability to hit other West Coast cities, provided they can, you know, shoot it up and get it to land where they want. You know, it's a real threat, you know, something we probably ought to all be thinking a lot more about. I don't think the answer is buildup. I think the answer is debuilding. You know, it's the ultimate answer.
You mean like diplomacy?
Well, diplomacy, yeah, that would be a good thing. But no, is disarmament of, you know, getting rid of nuclear weapons is sort of the direction that we have to go. But when you have a state like North Korea, it really creates a kind of, you know, possibility that's pretty scary if it actually...
Yes, just to add to that, the president of the National Bureau of Asian Research, who I spoke to, who's testified to Congress, and he's based in Seattle, in this interview, he said that China's been growing its military faster than we have, and that more importantly, mutually assured destruction still works, whether we like it or not. That's what actually keeps country safe, he told us.
But in that interview, which I thought was a great interview, I was happy to hear some of the stuff he was saying. He was talking about the, you know, we have this notion that everybody is downgrading and everybody's holding back. But in fact, he was speaking of the fact that all the countries are upgrading and modernizing, including the U.S., and that is the way that you, with the promise of a second strike, you know, that is the way that you prevent this. To your metaphor of a Cold War, Russia and the U.S., that's feeling more like a bromance for the leaders at the top, right?
Isn't that a strange...
Who say the craziest things about each other and the craziest things about what the other one said of him. He thinks I'm brilliant, or whatever that was. I mean, you know, this is really surreal, what's going on with that and the investigation into the election hacking.
I don't want to be around for the bromance breakup. That is going to be ugly.
Yeah.
I thought that was a great interview, too, you did with the expert on arms in Asia. I don't know that I was glad to hear it just because it was scary. There was a topic he brought up that I hadn't really heard much about or thought much about, the neutron bomb.
Yes.
I have another thing now on my list of worries.
Yes. This is a radiation attack. It's a bomb that's not a concussive explosion type of bomb, but it's just spreading sickening radiation.
Yeah.
And he had an interesting phrase. What did he say? Something like, we don't talk about it because it's too thinkable. He made it sound like that's something we really, that's really a possibility. It's more doable than global annihilation.
Right.
Well, you know, after 9/11, there was a lot of discussion about dirty bombs and, you know, the Iraq program and people getting enriched uranium from Russia or some other source and making these bombs. And then that seemed to fade. I mean, with more the kind of warfare that has been fought and America kind of moving on, being distracted by other things, we've kind of lost touch with the threat of what, you know, and the economic impact of what would happen when those neutron bombs, as I understand them, they basically don't destroy a city. They just kill everything. You know, everything just dies, so you're not actually like blowing up infrastructure. And so for some people, that
at least we'll have the infrastructure
for the aftertimes. Right. Anyway,
sounds like Blade Runner.
But so I think in a way this is good in the sense that this is stuff we should be thinking about. Mm-hmm. It's stuff we should be preparing for. It's not like everybody's supposed to run out and build a bomb shelter, but policy wise, it's really important to deal with it, I think.
You just hope that the communication maybe stays on Twitter instead of going beyond Twitter, because you have, you know, President-elect Trump talking about it'll never happen. I mean, Trump and Kim Jong-un, that is just a horrible match if you think about it.
I would prefer it not to be on Twitter to begin with, that any discussion of something this serious and this consequential would stay off of Twitter.
You know, I follow this story in the hearings into the Russian hacking and President-elect Trump doesn't believe his own intelligence community. And I can get with the idea that they ought to be on the same page and listening to each other. And yet I know that our intel was wrong on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. And I just can't tell. I only know in theory what I think about all this stuff. And I really don't know enough about how all this works to know what the downside is of Trump and Putin being cozy or Trump being...
Well, here's a question. You have this uncertainty, right?
Yeah.
Because you're not...
I'm not smart.
Intelligence, right. Why does Donald Trump have such certainty that he knows?
Yeah.
Well, because he thinks the best thoughts and he uses the best words.
Or does he just keep... He says he keeps people off balance. I'm not going to tell him my secret plan. And then we just... I feel that we just react to our opinions about people like that without actually knowing how the levers of intelligence and military work.
Well, also, when you go back to like the Iraq situation, you have to remember that there were people in the intelligence community themselves who said these things were not happening and were not threats. It was policymakers at the top who took the information or took bad information and turned it into PR.
Right. So cherry-picked it.
Yeah. So you had Cheney and Colin Powell and other people who were selling bad information. Mm. When people in the intelligence community knew that it was less reliable and they were being ignored. And I think that's, you know, one of the issues that was brought up yesterday at the congressional testimony and was there's a difference between skepticism and disparagement.
Yes.
In other words, publicly attacking your own intelligence apparatus helps your enemies.
Why is that? Yeah. How does it benefit the enemy?
Well, it creates...
It shows weakness. It creates shows uncertainty. Weakness and division,
yeah,
right?
Shows weakness, division, creates uncertainty. If you have intelligence people starting to chase their own tails or cover their butts or, you know, whatever, as opposed to actually drilling down. And the intelligence is more than just spies. I mean, it involves all kinds of analysis from people who are real experts in subjects, you know, drilling down. They have no control over what policymakers actually do with the information. But if you begin kind of questioning the whole process, you know, it's not to say the president shouldn't question. I mean, you know, look at with fresh eyes and fresh people and that kind of thing. But it is to say, you know, that if you go around basically saying these people are on a witch hunt or whatever, you're politicizing a process that it's really important to depoliticize so that you're actually dealing with facts.
Or turn it around another direction. The New York Times alluded to this in an editorial, I think, yesterday. Say Donald Trump, when he's president, gets information from intelligence agencies saying, to take the North Korea scenario, that they are going to launch a nuclear missile at Seattle. And he tries to act on it and tries to inform the public. And he says this is based on our intelligence after he's just spent, you know, his whole term plus the run up to his term trashing the credibility of our intelligence agencies. In other words, he may need the credibility of the intelligence community, not to mention their information, as president. And if he destroys that credibility, he harms himself and potentially the country's ability to respond to real threats. The other thing that's scary is that, you know, people talk a lot about Trump as an autocrat or a dictator, totalitarian. This is what they do. They create a kind of culture or a sense of reality in which there is no arbiter of truth except for the single leader. You can't trust anyone except me, says Donald Trump. That's totalitarianism.
Oh, I think this is a really delicate area for the president-elect because it sets him up almost immediately at odds, not only with the intelligence communities, you know, because he just dissed them and put their intelligence in quotes and all that business, but it sets him up at odds with Republican senators who I don't know that they're saying the intelligence information is 100%, you know, dead on, but they're saying we have to listen to it and we have to pursue it. And so that puts and don't forget the whole reason that he doesn't like some of this information is that it undermines his big, big, huge victory.
OK, I'm inclined to believe all this. And so I'm going to resolve to in this year talk to more experts like the one I did this week and understand how the politicizing and the weakness and division and totalitarianism might work. What if we got more smart in 2017 about all this stuff? OK, thanks, team. We're going to talk about politics and end zones, and when is it ethical to pressure a white supremacist's mommy, and more coming up on the Week in Review. Eli Sanders won a Pulitzer Prize, and he's associate editor at The Stranger, and Joni Balter hosts Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel, and Knute Berger is Crosscut columnist, the Mossback. He writes for Seattle Met Magazine, too, and we're all together with you. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting at KUOW and reviewing the week gone by. And speaking of Twitter, our social media producer, Kara McDermott, is watching the conversation. Kara, what are listeners saying?
Yes, we've had a few tweets in the last few minutes. Tannen Baldwin said, if you look at the history of the Cold War, it was never really over. And by the way, I'm tweeting via voice in traffic.
Yes, a reference to our distracted driving conversation earlier.
And on that note, Colin Martin also tweeted at us saying, as a medic in Seattle, I have to say that using phones causes infinitely fewer accidents than tailgating. Enforce that law first.
Yeah. What about the tailgating?
Go for both of them.
But to Joni, she thinks it's doesn't matter how far you, whether you don't even have to be moving, but you think even even texting at a stoplight is explosive.
I'm coming after you, Bill.
Yes, it's true. Also this week, in fact, last night, one of the Seahawks star players, the Pro Bowl lineman Michael Bennett, took the stage at Town Hall Seattle to say that it's time for athletes to get political. Bennett wore, you may remember, a Black Lives Matter T-shirt to training camp and has a lot to say about a lot of issues and has criticized especially black athletes who endorse Gatorade but won't really say what's actually on their mind.
When people want us just to be, you know, just a part of the brands and sell things, it just gets, it just becomes, it just makes you go crazy because it's like when it's time to speak about things that are great, they won't let you do it. But when it's time to sell something, it's like everybody's pushing you towards it. And it's just, and it sucks sometimes.
Bennett also put it back on the fans, though, reminding us that we don't really object to there being a team called the Washington Redskins. Not really.
I don't think the name should be there. I think it's a name that, you know, you can, you think about Native Americans, all you can do is, you know, shed a tear for all the trials and tribulations that they have dealt with. You know, a country that used to be theirs is not theirs anymore. And for them to look at a logo as it's as racist as it can be. You know what I mean? I've never seen anything more racist. I definitely think they should change it. I don't know what it's going to take and how long it's going to take it, but it would be, that's another thing. If the name needs to be changed, you know who has to change the name? The fans. If the fans don't go to the game, that name will change the next day. But everybody can say they have an issue with it, but that stadium is still filled up every Sunday. So until people are like, you know what, I'm not watching the Redskins anymore because they need to change their name, I swear, I bet you if they lose a couple million dollars of a couple games, they're not good anyway, but if they were to lose money, it would change. It would change the day. It would change the same day. That's why I say people have power, and we think we don't have power, but we have all the power because we control what is happening.
Seahawks star Michael Bennett was on stage last night with the sports editor of The Nation magazine, Dave Zirin, who was on the show yesterday, saying that I was surprised when he said that he thought that that 2016 in sports will be talked about the way 1968 in sports was, when, you know, Muhammad Ali and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and John Carter fist raised at the Olympics. And I was asking him, really? I mean, Colin Kaepernick knelt during the national anthem and we don't talk about it much anymore. And he said, well, there's been a Trump election effect when it comes to what the media has been saying about sports and politics. But he thinks something is changing. And I wanted to know, Canute, as you're the biggest Seahawks fan here, do fans
think
want
his outfit?
Yeah, he's decked
Friday.
Out.
Blue
it's
Friday.
Blue Friday for Canute. And do you think fans want to know what linemen and punters think about police accountability? Do you get that impression?
I don't know. I don't think that the sort of average sports fan, I think they tend to look at things like professional sports as a escape from politics, escape from the sort of daily grind. They don't want to tune into sports radio and get a political lecture from somebody. But I also think if your team is winning, they're highly tolerant. And I think a lot of the politics that are spoken by Michael Bennett and to some extent Richard Sherman and some of the other members of the team, they're speaking in a community that's pretty sympathetic to a lot of those issues. And we're a fairly liberal, progressive community. We have our issues. But so I don't think fans here have let it get in the way. The other thing I would say is that football, just talking about football, you know, football already is a political sport. I mean, it's been run by white guys with, you know, military drill sergeant haircuts demanding everybody else, you know, have a haircut.
Salute the flag.
The military.
Build them a stadium.
The you know, yeah, there's the national anthem and the flag. But, you know, there's been a lot, especially since 9/11, even more kind of militarization of the ceremony around games and that kind of thing. And
you have gender norms happening in front of you. And you have, as Michael Bennett talked about, the corporate tie-ins. And so it's not like it's a politics-free zone ever.
Yeah, exactly. And even now you have, like during this last campaign, you had college coaches and professional coaches endorsing or expressing sympathy for Donald Trump, for example. So it's... you know, it's not like it's depoliticized. I think people get irritated when it either kind of runs counter to the values of the community or if they're hearing something they don't want to hear. But I think also there's this impulse to kind of let sports be an escape.
I have no problem with the players coming out and saying things that that really bother them. I thought Michael Bennett made a compelling case about, you know, they don't just want to be, you know, yelling for Gatorade or other things like that.
So Russell Wilson has a Make America Great Again cap, all good?
Probably not, but Russell Wilson is involved in...
I'm not saying he does, by the way. I'm just saying, opinions do you want to hear?
I think you'll hear from him on that one. But, I mean, Russell Wilson is involved in an effort to bring an NBA team here. They do have other parts of their lives. But I'll just maybe even quibble with the notion here. I think 2016 will be remembered as the year the Chicago Cubs won after 108 years. I mean... politics has been part of sports for a very long time. Think of all the Olympic Games that many times had different kinds of protests at them. You know, the one truth about sports and politics is the ratings started going down for the NFL here in the early part of the season. And the sense was, are these lame games that are on? Actually, it turned out, if you looked at some of the rating stories, that folks had really gone to watch politics. And when the election was over, they came back. And they were still watching games that were good, bad, and not so good.
We were talking about this issue months ago. I mean, it's been going on for months. But I was here on the show when the Seahawks were taking knees and then talking about, you know,
taking knees meaning during the national anthem.
Yeah, sorry.
Linking arms in some cases, yes.
Right. And the question is, well, what does it actually accomplish? And the Seahawks said, yeah, that's a fair question, and we're going to go on kind of like a listening tour. They set up a meeting with Ed Murray,
yep.
The police department, I think. They wanted to learn more. And as we were chatting about it on the show, I said, hey, I've got an idea for something they could do. And we talked about how every Seahawk listens to this show.
Yes.
Religiously.
Yep.
And I suggested that the Seahawks
documented.
Go down to Olympia and get involved in this conversation over changing Washington State's outlier law on unjustified police killings.
Mm-hmm.
Well, two Seahawks did.
Doug Baldwin. At least Doug Baldwin.
At least
or
Doug
one
did.
Seahawk did. Yeah. Sorry. Doug Baldwin. And
the receiver.
Excuse me. Yeah. So he was there when this panel that was considering whether to change the law was having one of its final meetings. And guess what? A lot of media showed up. And that day, the committee voted to seriously change the law, to recommend seriously changing the law. And now there's more wind behind that effort in the state legislature. We'll see if it actually happens. But you know what will pressure legislators to actually vote to change the law? If the Seahawks keep showing up.
I think there are a couple of real positives for the Seahawks. One is that Pete Carroll, the coach, has cultivated a team of individuals, and those people act and speak out. I think that's great. You know, two, it's they are successful enough that we actually listen to what they say. I mean, there were so many years, so many decades went by when nobody could have cared less about what they said on a particular political topic. I mean, I didn't know that Steve Largent, the great hero of the early Seahawks, was a right-wing conservative until after he left the Seahawks and got elected to Congress and, you know, was in favor of things like bear baiting and, you know, things that I never would have supported. And I think that for a lot of those years, there was simply a kind of indifference.
Right. So if you ever think, I don't care about sports, they don't matter, we just made the case for why you arguably ought to care how the Seahawks do on the field and what they say off the field. And that can extend to other sports. Shall we move on? Let's talk white supremacists and trolls and disappearing, vanishing Seattle when we come back on KOW's Week in Review. It's the Week in Review on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke here with Joni Balter and Knute Berger and Eli Sanders, who spent the Christmas holidays in Whitefish, Montana, home of the mother of a white supremacist Nazi?
Well, yeah, close.
Proto-Nazi, neo-Nazi.
Neo-Nazi, I think, would be more
aspiring.
More appropriate.
It's aspirational. What does Richard Spencer's mother have to do with this?
Well, let's talk about Richard Spencer first. So the town that I went to, because I have family there and I go there sometimes for the holiday season, is Whitefish, Montana. It's a very small, very liberal speck in a giant sea of red Montana. And Richard Spencer, who's about my age, I think he's 38 maybe, has made Whitefish his part-time home recently. Who is Richard Spencer? He's the guy who came up with the phrase alt-right, which is kind of this Nazi-washing term that is meant to obscure neo-Nazi beliefs, white nationalist beliefs. He wants a separate white homeland, for example, within the United States, or, I don't know, outside the United States maybe, for white people, things like that. He believes that he has academic proof, supposedly, that other races are inferior to white people, on and on. So Richard Spencer has made Whitefish his part-time home, and Whitefish has understandably been trying to figure out how to show him the door. What's made it possible, it seems like, for Richard Spencer to have such a nice life in Whitefish is his well-to-do parents, who have a really nice home on the ski mountain there, and his mother owns a building that she had constructed in downtown Whitefish that she rents out to vacationers, you know, skiers, and also some small business owners who use the downstairs of it for their offices. So at a certain point, she felt that she was being pressured by the community in Whitefish, and in particular a group that calls itself Love Lives Here. This is kind of the anti-hate group in Whitefish. And she went public, along with Richard, went public with this supposed pressure campaign to get her, she said, to sell her place, to denounce her son, to make a donation to Love Lives Here. And when she went public with this, a troll army, which is a term that didn't exist in my brain, at least until recently, a troll army of white supremacist online thugs descended as revenge on the town of Whitefish, believing her story of victimhood and saying, we are now going to target Jewish business owners in Whitefish for their attacks on
target them. How they physically came to Whitefish, or they're just tweeting things about these businesses.
They went to the Yelp reviews for these businesses and left, you know, terrible reviews. They went to the Google reviews and left terrible reviews. They did everything they could to kind of trash the businesses online, and they also called. So businesses were getting tons of, you know, hateful messages. There's a business in Whitefish that's owned by a family with the last name of Metzl. They were targeted. The Metzls are not Jewish. This happened to a lot of business owners in Whitefish who are not Jewish, but were swept up in this just ugly, undifferentiated anti-Semitism from the troll army that was acting at the urging of a guy named Andrew Anglin, who's part of the Daily Stormer website.
Not that we prefer the differentiated anti-Semitism.
No, but just to give you a sense of how gross and kind of gross in the sense of like not even accurately targeted this was.
And none of that is going to be helped by this march that's apparently on for Martin Luther King Day, through the streets of Whitefish.
Yeah,
that's
there are two events that are worth noting. Tomorrow, January 7th, there's going to be a rally in Whitefish for the community to show, you know, their horror at all of this and their support for religious freedom, diversity, and just to show what the community is. It's a liberal, accepting, welcoming community.
How did Whitefish, Montana get so liberal?
That is a good question. But it's a ski town, and it has a lot of interaction with, you know, quote-unquote, coastal elites.
Coastal elites.
But it also has the attributes that make up, you know, the liberal world, and in particular Hillary Clinton supporters. It's more educated on average than the rest of Montana, and it's a little wealthier on average than the rest of Montana.
So a question about the original charge. When you say that some people pressured Richard Spencer's mother to sell or move? Pressure meaning what? They just called on her to? Asked her to?
Well, so this is what's disputed, and I wish that I could tell you exactly what happened, but no one knows exactly what happened. All that's clear is that Richard Spencer's mother, Sherry Spencer, and Richard Spencer himself successfully emerged from whatever happened with a victimhood narrative that they shared nationally. And that was so persuasive to the alt-right, the so-called alt-right, the white nationalist community that is, you know, already primed to see themselves as victims, right? That it led to these actions. And to as Joni said, now this march that is being promised, we'll see if it actually materializes.
Yeah, but that kills the whole victimhood because they're the protagonists in that, right?
Well, if they show up, as they're promising, on January 15th, which is the day before Martin Luther King Day, to march for white nationalism in Whitefish, Montana with guns, which is what they're promising.
And a member of Hamas, supposedly.
Yeah, it's gotten bizarre. There is not, as far as I know, any permit requested for this yet. And, you know, Republican and Democratic leaders in Montana are saying we don't want this here. But, yeah, this may happen on the 15th. And if it does, I don't think there are a lot of people buying the, like, victimhood narrative here. But if it does, certainly it won't help the victimhood narrative. But there is a question that I think you're getting at here, Bill, which is, say a community legitimately wants to get a white supremacist out of town, Richard Spencer. And they believe that his mother is essentially harboring him, right? Making it possible for him to stay in the town. They don't say you don't know for sure whether she's a white supremacist. She's since said she's not a racist and so on.
But has she ever done anything to try to tamp this down? I mean, she's able-bodied. She can speak. She can do things to kind of turn down the heat there
if she wants to. So her son, and people probably saw this video, was in Washington, D.C. right after Trump's election and held a meeting where he really riled up this white supremacist crowd, this white nationalist meeting. And all these people in the crowd gave Sieg Heil Hitler Nazi salutes, basically.
Yep.
And Richard Spencer, you've probably seen that video if you're paying attention. Richard Spencer is the guy on the stage leading the crowd that then does this.
Yes.
So, yeah, you would think that at that point, you know, a certain number of mothers would denounce their sons and say, this is dangerous, what you're doing.
You can also call them on the back channel. And, you know, I mean, there's right. There's this thing called cell phones.
What she says, the kind of moral quandary that she tries to propose or tried to propose in a post that she wrote on Medium, which asks, the headline is something like, does love really live here in Montana? Hmm. She said something like, in what moral system is it right to punish the mother for the quote-unquote, she put this in quotes, sins of the son?
A biblical reference.
Oh my.
Yeah,
oh
definitely.
My.
Definitely. An Old Testament call out. So she is saying it's not fair to hold me responsible. But people,
well, then be responsible and do something that people would go, oh, yeah, that's responsible.
Well, so, yeah, then you come back and you say, well, you should have denounced your son. If you care about this community or if you care about this country, you should have publicly denounced him. And then people who are friendly with or supportive of Sherry Spencer will come back and say, as someone in Whitefish did to me, well, what kind of society are we living in when we make family members denounce other family members for their political beliefs? This sounds like Stalinism.
Yeah. Well, so that I would think the answer hangs on what actually happened to Richard Spencer's mother.
Right.
Are we saying that somebody just said their opinion? Hey, would you mind leaving town so Richard Spencer doesn't hang around here? We'd all be happier. Or did somebody do something much more heinous to the guy's mom?
There are some specifics to it, but not enough. There's a Jewish real estate agent named Tanya Gersh who was talking, it seems like, to Sherry Spencer about what was going on, about the possibility that there might be a protest against her property in Whitefish. And, you know, when you think about it, if she hadn't denounced her son yet, she hadn't made any statements, you could imagine people getting ready to protest her, right? So maybe Tanya Gersh was just sharing this with her. But the conversation proceeded, and Tanya Gersh, it's clear, sent a couple emails to Sherry Spencer about the possibility of Sherry selling her property and making a donation to Love Lives Here. What you can't see is what Sherry Spencer said to Tanya Gersh, what email she may have sent to the real estate agent. But Sherry Spencer kind of selectively put out just two emails from Tanya Gersh and says this is proof of a pressure campaign.
I haven't heard from Knute Berger yet about this long and fascinating story. Any reaction, Mossback?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's really appalling in a lot of ways. Of course, the neo-Nazis have said that in this march that they're going to be armed. So the suggestion of violence or potential violence is there. I think, you know, another thing to note is that on the white supremacist far right for a long time and currently there is a movement to colonize the sort of Pacific Northwest because they see it as the term is the last redoubt. They see it as the last white place in America. There are not many minorities here. There's certainly not many African Americans. And so places like Eastern Washington, Oregon, not just Eastern, but Western too, Montana, Idaho, these places are kind of rallying points. I've heard podcasts, the neo-Nazi podcasts, telling people, move to Montana, move to Oregon, move to Washington. This is before the election, before Trump.
But all of this is only if you can get away with it. In other words, if the community doesn't respond, and this community in Whitefish is responding.
Right. But I think that the notion is here is that going back to the point that Eli was making, this is a small blue dot in a sea of red, in a sea of white, an area where there are vulnerabilities and there's publicity, et cetera, to exploit. This stuff is not the first Nazi march in the Northwest. It's, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important also to kind of look at the big picture. What's the political agenda of the people who are trying to make this a lightning rod for white supremacism?
And is this not another example? We talk about the Big Sort, where we're in bubbles and we don't reach across. So here is a rare liberal town in the inland Northwest who would like to be in more of a bubble than they are.
Right.
They would like to segregate their town into, they'd like to be more blue and less red, and not just red. I understand these are neo-Nazis, but I'm just pointing out that we talk about how we want to get along and understand one another, but a lot of times we really would like to be not living with the people who we don't want to live with.
Yeah, and this is an example kind of in the extreme of a phenomenon that we see here in Seattle all the time. What are the limits then that we are willing to place potentially on ideas like free speech to enforce our desired bubbles, right? Well, or how do we shun someone, which is what's going on in Whitefish, without turning them into a martyr or a victim in a way that really helps the political aims that Knute is talking about.
I can't help but think about the mom And the rest of the community, there must be people. It's a small town. They all know each other. Many of them know each other. Mm-hmm. They have ways to communicate that are way different from what's going on right now. And you have to wonder, yes, they should all be reaching to figure out how to not make their town look so horrible from this. And that sounds like, I don't know, the mayor calls up, you know, all the parties and they meet at a coffee shop. They do something to kind of to bring this down a notch. It's if I lived in that town, I'd be just embarrassed that that's what was happening.
Well, back in the 90s, people used to joke about the Reich of Idaho because of the Aryan Nations and all that kind of thing. Idaho is a very conservative state, but, you know, the business community and others got really upset with being identified with neo-Nazis marching with swastikas down the streets of their towns. And, you know, they pushed back.
Yeah, we've never said whitefish this much in
years. Is, well, the people of Whitefish are really upset and worried that all of this national repetition of the name of their town in the same sentence as white supremacist is going to do exactly what Canute is saying, turn them in the national consciousness to Sandpoint.
Well, we'll see what happens. Was it tomorrow?
Tomorrow is an event for tolerance. And the 15th, supposedly.
Might be the 16th. They were playing around with the dates, right?
Yeah, so you got to watch
Luther King Day weekend.
Yeah, it's the white supremacist march, maybe.
We just have a couple of minutes. I want to tell people, don't throw that away. That is your democracy voucher. Seattle residents have just gotten or are about to get 4 democracy vouchers in the mail. We have a minute left. Joni, we're the first American city to try this. Don't throw away what? What are these things? How does
it
work?
Throw away these $25 coupons that come in because you can use them. And you guys had a pretty cool graphic on how they would be processed through King County elections and all of that.
Yeah.
But you can use them to support the city candidate of your choice. The idea here, I'm not sure I'm the biggest fan of this, but the idea here is to give people a sort of an easier way to participate in the city council elections. It would bring sort of more people into the election system, and that's a good thing.
You don't have to be a registered voter or a citizen.
Yeah, it's just a way of saying, you know, like, even if you're not a registered voter or a citizen, you have something to say. It's a way of saying something about a race. So
give this voucher to the candidate, and so the candidate has to raise that much less money. So candidates have to raise money.
Right. The candidates who receive these have to abide by certain rules.
A limit on contribution limits.
Right. And participating in debates, which is that stuff is all good, healthy stuff.
Okay. So the goal is that this is supposed to spruce up our democracy a little bit in Seattle. We're the first American country to try this, and we'll have a lot of opinions as this actually rolls out. Joni Balter, who is the host of Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel, Canute Berger, writer with Crosscut and Seattle Met Magazine, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, and you can find that graphic and more about your democracy vouchers at KUOW.org. Thanks, everybody. Good to see you again in the new year, and thanks for reviewing the news.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Good to see you all.